You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, my beautiful MFs. I'm a little late getting this one out. I apologize. I've been traveling quite a bit. I had a root canal, had some other things going on, but hopefully I'll make up for it with some lengthy content here. I've got a lot to say today. Last week, we talked about mindset, of course, and today I plan to add a few more reframes to your repertoire. Reframe repertoire. That's fun to say, right? Could I say it three times fast? I don't know. Let's see. Reframe repertoire, reframe repertoire, reframe repertoire. That last one kind of sounded like wepertoire. Remember Fetty Wep or Fetty Wap? What was it? Fetty Wap was popular back about 10 years ago when I met my trap queen. I was like, hey, what's up? Hello. But let's start with some funnies. I've got more funnies than usual this week, so let's get started, and I'll do an update on the best movie ever and money stuff at the end. Savvy on X says, help me understand, what is the point of a pergola? Is it for people who want striped tans? Yeah, I share that, not because it's funny necessarily, but I did notice a pergola craze back about 20 years ago. When I was a kid, we had a covered porch area in the back. In my backyard, and then my parents decided they wanted a bigger covered area of the patio, wanted more coverage. So they didn't add a roof with holes in it. They added just another roof. But I'm not player hating from the sideline. I don't have a pergola. My bro has a covered patio in his backyard, and when he wanted more coverage, he half-assed it. Got a pergola. Why? I don't know. I'll ask him. It looks good. I'm not clowning. I don't know what the deal is with that, and I still don't know. I don't know if it's still that popular. But I'll get back to you in a future Mano episode. The Babylon Bee. Now, be forewarned, some of these funnies are going to be political because there's a lot going on in the best movie ever right now, which I will get to. Quite a few updates in that thriller of a movie. Why everybody on LinkedIn thrilled all the time. The Babylon Bee, quite a few good ones. One says, polls show majority of Democrats believe Lincoln assassination was staged. Here's one from Ann Coulter. You know, something about Ann Coulter that's interesting that happened to me. She used to write a weekly column. Maybe she still does. I don't know. But this must have been 2008. I would occasionally read her columns. And the IT guys where I worked, they were big Obama guys. And one day I logged on and I got the 504 error. And so the site was blocked. I couldn't access it anymore. Anyway, she posted the night of the White House correspondence dinner, just as it was being postponed or canceled. She said, why didn't the mentalists see this coming? Which I guess is like saying, how come a fortune teller doesn't at least have a small fortune? Or how does the guy giving you stock picks, how does he have time to do that? Wouldn't he be too busy getting rich himself to help the little guy? I don't know. Maybe he's just real generous, but I doubt it. How's he going to sacrifice the millions in profits he could be making for himself to instead charge you a few thousand bucks for his newsletter? How does that make sense? Here's something. This one's a dirty joke that I'm sure will get this episode labeled explicit, but I'm going to do it anyway because I have a very listening audience to please and somebody's bound to find it funny. Grand Regent Valiant on X says, I sometimes let my dick make decisions. I call that cognitive thinking. Yeah, I know. How old are you, man? I am 45. So let's do another one. Somebody named 7CC posted the top 10 countries in the world according to penis size. Now, I know you birthers from the Obama days are going to think Kenya's on the list. You would be correct. Kenya measures up at the 12th on the list. behind Sudan, Congo, Ecuador, Ghana, Nigeria, Venezuela, Lebanon, Colombia, which is much needed, right? If you're forced to deal with the BBLs all the time. It's the cosmetic capital of the world. Then you got Cameroon, Jamaica, and Kenya at 12. Now you know. So good on you, birthers. But you girthers are out of luck. At least until we see a circumference list. I'll share it when it's out. The top comment from a Caucasian man named Matthias Schmidt. He said, "Why is my wife planning a girls' trip to Sudan?" Staying on topic with this one. All the kids these days seem to be talking about body counts. You notice that? And I would argue it's not because they're curious. It's because they're dumb. But Red Rum, he had a thinker on this. He said, when she starts talking about body counts, you've genuinely got to explain that scoring 10 goals is not the same as conceding 10 goals. All right, enough of that. This is from the New York Post, something a little more serious. Remember the New York Post, the paper that was started over 200 years ago and was banned from Twitter back during the communist takeover for the reason of breaking the Hunter Biden laptop story? That New York Post. They had an article out on Wednesday about a Taco Bell worker in Florida. This Taco Bell employee fired a gun at three female customers after one of them tried to fill their water cup with soda. But the funny part came from me, I must say, as I retweeted to my dozens of followers. How come nobody want to follow me on there? I don't even have personal friends on X. I maybe have like 10 that I know personally. Where y'all all at? Where are you getting your news? Because I'm getting tired and sick of speaking into the void on X. So join a brother next time. But no, my comment was this. I said, if successful, meaning if the Taco Bell employee had been successful, meaning if he had killed one of them, I said, if successful, it would have been the first murder while attempting a suicide. You get me? Who among us has never tried a suicide at the fountain drink when they were a kid? The fountain drink machine. And one of my new friends on there, or one of my, I shouldn't say new, we've been friends for a while, one of my few friends on there, he gave me a couple of laughing emojis, which I really appreciate. So I've been riding high on that for about 48 hours. That friend of mine, he's a total stud, by the way, Jake Housen is his name. He's the only guy that I know who attended both Sci Falls High School in Houston, where I went, and then also got an athletic scholarship to play football at Nicholls State University. So he was a freshman at Nicholls when I was a senior. And I just want to say, Jake, if you're listening, I like the shit out of you, man. And I really appreciate you used to come to a lot of baseball games. And I like your dad, too. I always enjoy talking to him. They're just good people. But Jake was a big offensive lineman, like a giant. And I remember playing the outfield and I could see that he was at the game from the outfield because he's such a big dude. And I don't know if he was coming to the games because we had that Cy Vols connection. But I appreciated it. And he had a stellar collegiate career, I might add. He played a large role on the Southland Conference championship team. They won it in 05, and he's got a ring to prove it. Speaking of rings, I saw this the other day. Somebody posted, "How did we all fall for the high school ring scam?" It's an interesting thought, right? Just about everybody bought one. As if graduating from high school is some big achievement. And this is related. I saw this a while back. Somebody named Kate Feedy, she made a good point. She said, it's extremely important, especially for kids who are in gifted programs or honor students or magna cum laude or whatever, to have a moment before adulthood when you realize all that actually means, it doesn't mean much. It means very little. And you are pretty much just a regular person. Amen. I don't have a class ring, actually, from high school or college. In fact, I didn't even attend my college graduation. We had a three-game series in Texas State, at Texas State at that time. So we were 10 hours away while my graduation was going on. But I didn't avoid buying the high school ring because I thought it was a scam or that I was above it or anything. When I was a kid, I actually admired the rings my dad had. He would wear his Brother Martin ring. Brother Martin High School in New Orleans, and he had one from UNO, where he went to college. But my rationale at the time was just that I didn't think it was worth it, and I knew it would sit in a box for the rest of my life because I didn't really like wearing jewelry. Still don't. Except for this gold grill. You know, I like to stay icy. This ain't no middle of the mall shit. I got the price of a mansion on my neck and wrist. And that gold grill, that's a relic of my being from the Paul Wall era. Paul Wall, baby. He graduated from Jersey Village in H-Town, class of 98, same like me. Jersey Village is in the, we were in the same Sci-Fair school district, but I don't think he played sports because I didn't know him at that time. But I saw he performed the other night at the Rockets game. I guess it was during halftime. So that's probably why he's top of mind. My Rockets are trying to come back from a 3-0 deficit against Bronny James and his dad. Shall see if they can pull it off without Kevin Durant. That Reed Shepherd is fast becoming my new favorite player. But I think we're missing a Vernon Maxwell type. Or a Pat Beverly, even better. I liked Pat Beverly. But Vernon Maxwell, I've seen him on podcasts. He's got some great stories. I really like hearing him tell stories from his playing days. Old number 11. Did you see where Ilhan Omar was reading something about the Great War? Called it World War 11. Which, that's not a big deal, right? I could see my five-year-old doing that, reading the two Roman numerals as 11. So we should give her a break. She's got a lot going on, trying to manage a winery and daycares, and she's probably got to wash her face 10 times a day since she looks like what happens when the TP is too thin. But what was I going to say? Let's get back on track. I was going to say, I have always, this is related to the ring, I've always treated other people's money like it's my money, if it's somebody I care about, or if it's a client especially, somebody I'm representing in a financial transaction. And I think one of the reasons I would attribute some of this attitude to successes that I've had selling real estate, because it's rather unique, because I know a lot of unscrupulous realtors who are just in it for themselves. It can be hard to find a good one. But contrary to those people who I hope you never come across, when you're making what is likely the biggest purchase of your life, I thought I was different. I would frequently talk clients out of buying houses about a couple times a year, which would hurt my bottom line, of course, but help my opinion of myself. If there's one thing I despise, it's seeing people take advantage of, especially when there's information asymmetry that is inherent in most financial dealings. Although I should say that information asymmetry is, or that imbalance is being leveled thanks to technology and the ubiquity of information, but it's still there. There's still information kept proprietary thanks to lobbyists and, you know, people who lobby the government to keep things the way they are. Anti-progressives, I guess. But the bad guys among them, sadly, they will, even when they're fighting for more transparency in pricing, just as an example, they're going to do it haphazardly, and it's going to appear to be consumer advocacy, but it's a lot of times it's for self-interest reasons, which is why I've always had a problem with people just blanket saying, well, realtors are in it for themselves, or insurance salesmen, or accountants, doctors, lawyers, used car salesmen especially, you know, you name it, any profession. It's generally not a profession problem. It's a human thing. It's a human problem. There are going to be bad apples in every profession, which is maybe why we should go easy on the commies, right? Because they're helpless in these situations, because they're totally not able to discern who is a good guy and who is in it for themselves. So getting taken advantage of by these folks probably makes them even more bitter than they already were. Maybe that's why they've got so much hate in their heart. But it's hard to feel sorry for them because they're bad guys themselves and probably would do the same thing in their situation. So maybe that's where it started. I don't know. They're dummies in this all-important aspect of life. And I say in this aspect because they're obviously not stupid. Some of these assassins, they're turning out to be Ivy Leaguers like Luigi and this latest one. But you live long enough in the real world and you soon realize that their school smarts has nothing to do with gullibility. Like, the smartest guy I know is so bad at discerning who is lying and who is not. And this latest fella, he wasn't some genius with original thoughts. That manifesto that was released, that could have been written by Rachel Maddow or Robert Reich or anybody with leftist talking points. It was straight out of the communist playbook. All right, more funnies before we get to the meat and potatoes. This is a gal, Saren Gale. She's an obvious misandrist. Am I saying that right? That's one of those words you see in writing more than verbalized. Saren Gale, she's a female feminist. She says, if men didn't exist, I would simply go for a 2 a.m. walk every night and listen to music in my AirPods. To which the top comment was, if men didn't exist, there would not be AirPods or streets. I was telling you last week that I've been swimming quite a bit on doctor's orders. Well, yesterday I forgot I had AirPods in my ears because you don't feel them, which can be good and bad, because you can jump into a pool with them and not realize you're still wearing them. And so when I got out, I looked back and they were at the bottom of the deep end. So I went down there and got them. And can you believe they still work? That is awesome. Good on you, Apple. And I see their stock is up about 5% today. I'm recording this on Friday. What's not awesome is at my first thought, well, this is good and bad. I thought I had an excuse to get the new ones that allow for the instant translation of foreign languages. I really want that, but I think I'm going to wait until I lose these in the ocean or something. Here's another funny from the Babylon Bee. It says, James Comey produces letter signed by 51 former intelligence officials saying he's totally innocent. This next one is courtesy of 50 Cent. He was replying to a comment made by P. Diddy's son. P. Diddy's son said, my daddy was not in no Epstein files. Meanwhile, these celebs are roaming free while being in them. And 50 said, MF, your dad was not in the files because he was creating his own files. Here's another Babylon Bee post that made the cut this week. It says, Trump enters ceasefire talks with Democrats. Next one. Liberals applaud improving diversity of would-be Trump assassins. Yeah, the guy was half black, half white. They had another one. This was with a picture of Jimmy Kimmel when he was talking about Melania being an expectant widow. Thinking that's funny. It said, nation longs for good old days when comedians were funny and didn't wish death on people. Gene Parmesan, he rarely misses. He created this little dialogue between Trump and Rubio. And I'll share it. It goes like this. Trump says, I need this ballroom. Rubio says, okay, let's stage an assassination attempt. Trump, perfect. Let's find the gayest, homosexual, Kamala-supporting brother possible to carry it out. Rubio, Trevor Noah? Trump says, no, gayer. Let's do a few more. Jim on Chain says, I like the gym because seeing the same five people every day and never speaking to them is the kind of socializing I enjoy. And this one deals with the Mike Vrabel thing from Boorish Sports. It says, if I had to bet on which of Diana Rossini's children grows up to be 6'4", 250 pounds, I would put my money on the one named Mike. Isn't that story is unbelievable. So if you're not following, not supposedly, there are pictures that were leaked of them kissing about 6 years ago. And remember, she's married. And then she has a child. And 4 days after the child is born, she posts on Twitter, sitting here with my baby, wondering who is the best Mike to ever coach in the NFL, best player and coach ever in the NFL. Not good. And saving the best for last, DJB posted this. He said, went to the Oreo website and hit accept all cookies. Now we wait. All right, with that, let's get into it. Reframe Your Brain. That's the book I talked about last week. It is a gem. It was written by the late Scott Adams, who I miss a lot. You know, who and whom That's one grammar thing I've never cared to get right. Despite, you know, I've done quite a bit of writing in my lifetime, and I have this weird thing where spelling and grammar have always kind of stuck. I'm pretty good at it. And it's, I don't know, it's just been kind of effortless. Like, I've never used spell check or anything. And that's a talent God blessed me with that was quite useful up until I was about 9. And then technology rendered that talent meaningless, as technology has done to so many of us. I sure wish I could have got some musical inclination or something, because music's not going anywhere. I talked about the HBO docuseries last week, The Defiant Ones, speaking of music, and they talked about how talented not just Jimmy Iovine was as an engineer and producer. You could tell he was a really smart dude, very, very high social intelligence, and mostly he just had this uncanny eye or ear for talent. I know The Voice is probably beneath him. I think he's retired, but the man would dominate those other celebs who sit in the chairs and spin around when they hear somebody that they like. Speaking of, did you see what Adam Levine did to his face? I got to ask my mom if her crush on him still stands. I think it was from the Babylon Bee. It said, oh, by the way, they were also banned during the communist takeover. They said, older woman gets Botox so she can look like an older woman who got Botox. Some of the stuff people are doing to their face is getting out of hand. Like, no way, after seeing how some of these people look ridiculous in their attempt to look younger, if I were to do something like that, I would have to get a written clause in the contract that would say something like, after this work is done, 100 people will be surveyed, kind of like the Family Feud, and it'll be anonymous, but these 100 people are going to be shown a before and after pic of my face, and if most of them believe I look older post-op, I want a refund. Because it does seem like it helps some people, but those some people generally have hundreds of millions of dollars. Like the Kardashian mom, I think she came out all right. She looks good. But if you need Kardashian money for that face work to look as intended, I don't know. Some of these people come out looking beat. And that wasn't a brag about my spelling ability. When you have a talent of any kind, I think it means you probably have a deficit somewhere else. And I certainly have those. But all your life you hear about all these geniuses who can't spell to save their life. Like, gun to their head, they couldn't spell civilization to save their life. I don't know why I remember things I do. Anybody else remember weird stuff from your childhood? Like, I could tell you about a conversation I had in third grade more so than I could tell you what I did the first weekend in April. Does your mind work that way? Like, just now, the reason I chose civilization, the word, was because in second grade, in Miss Toops's class at St. Joseph Elementary, we were doing this phonetic exercise. They were trying to get us hooked, if you know what I mean, on phonics. And this one gal in class, who I was a big fan of, still am, actually, I think she's a Facebook friend, Ellen, she gets up in front of class and she sounds out civilization, and nobody could guess what the word was because we were all 7 years old. And another teacher came into the class and was like, you are not going to believe this child. And so everybody was impressed. And so maybe that's why it stuck with me. But yeah, if I saw Ellen tomorrow, I'd give her a big hug because I'm so fond of some of those girls that I grew up with. And it wouldn't be a side hug either. Anybody else notice side hugs becoming more common? Or am I just creepy and people don't want to give me a regular hug? I don't know. Or is that a relic of the hashtag pound me too movement? The side hug? Who knows? But in second grade, we're doing this exercise. Everybody had to get up in front of the class and do this word and sound it out phonetically or whatever. And the first hand that goes up, Miss Toops would call on them and a kid would give their answer. Well, nobody guessed Ellen's. And she was bragged about to the hilt about this genius child as we played this phonetics game or phonics game, whatever you call it. Anyway, not all my stories are going to be bangers, I realize. I also remember when I learned the word despise, there was a kid I grew up with who was a wild child, like the worst behaved kid you could imagine. And he didn't bathe, so he stunk all the time. Sloppy parents. And this was in sixth grade, same year I bought my first Nirvana, my first CD, the Nirvana Nevermind CD with the naked baby on the cover. And we were doing this exercise where we had to say something good about our neighbor in class, the person who sat next to us. And this kid, Michael, who would go on to become a professional wrestler, he said of this poorly behaved kid, he said, "I don't have anything good to say about him. I actually despise him." And the teacher got so pissed. Ms. Schecksnyder was her name. She tore him a new one. And I remember going home and looking up the word because I didn't understand how could a word that I was pretty sure wasn't a curse word, because I would have known about it, how could that make her so mad? So that's when I learned the word despise. You might find this funny. Another story from second grade, same teacher, Miss Toops. One day, she was complaining about not feeling well, and she kind of wore her pants up like a tourist. Well, that day, when she said she wasn't feeling good, she patted and kind of rubbed under her belt. And she was saying, "I don't feel good. I don't feel so good," which I'm sure was anatomically correct. She was probably just patting her stomach. But at that age, at age 7, I thought girls' private parts were in the front, just like ours. I mean, why wouldn't I think that? I didn't have a sister or anything. So I thought she was patting her junk. And I went home and told my mom that the teacher was patting her private parts in class. but I had more to say about the who whom thing. So I was saying how a lot of smart people wear their inability to spell like a badge of honor, and how that's not me. Basic spelling and math and later simplifying life is something I'm pretty good at. But I don't know if I use who correctly or not. And I think my lack of concern is because, and I say think because this isn't something I've thought about before, but I want to always say who, regardless of what's true or what's correct, because I think whom sounds a little pretentious. But I'm sure I've said it at times. To whom is obviously correct, but that doesn't come up often. Even there, I think I would say to who. I want to say to who. And I'm definitely not a fan of removing all formality from this American life, as we seem to be doing. I want people to stop wearing pajamas to the airport. But you did that to who? Who's on first? I'm on first. And since I'm on first, I'm going to try to steal second. So let's talk about some sports real quick. I'll tell you a baseball story. And I'll tie it into something we talked about last week. I was a fast runner when I played. I loved to steal bases. And every time I got on base, I'd be thinking about stealing the next base. And that's thrilling. I was thrilled, like I was bragging about something on LinkedIn. But the little cat and mouse game you play with the pitcher and the catcher, and a lot of times the infielders and the coaches too, but you're not necessarily thinking about the coaches. But the coaches sometimes are making pitch out decisions, which shouldn't be allowed in my opinion. Or if pitch outs are allowed, I think it should be two balls instead of one ball. Chase, if you're listening, let's see about making that rule change. What do you think? Because by the end of my career, when teams figured out I was fast, I want to say maybe every time I was thrown out stealing as a senior, it was on a pitch out. I could be wrong, but they got me quite a bit on that. But I don't think I've shared this story before. So one time we were playing Sam Houston State at home, and their coach was this mean old man that they called Skeeter, or just Skeets. And I was standing on second base. And, well, no, I was taking my lead after just having stole second. And the time I was on base before that, I had stolen second and third. So I had 3 stolen bases at this point in this game. So old Skeeter calls time out and walks out to the pitcher's mound to talk to the pitcher. And I can see him looking over at me, like over the pitcher's shoulder, while he's giving this pitcher an ass chewing. And then when he's done with the pitcher, he walks out about halfway to second base, and he points at the shortstop, who's standing a few feet to my right, and then he points to the second baseman, and he says, talking about me, he says, "If that son of a bitch steals third base, you're both coming out of the game." You know what's funny? When I was little, my grandfather used to tell stories just like that. And I remember thinking when that was happening, when I was standing there on second base, Well, one, I was thinking they're not going to let me steal third. They'll make sure of that. And they didn't. They held me on real close. But two, I remember thinking that this is a story I'm probably going to tell my grandkids someday because it reminded me so much of the stories that I'd hear Pawpaw Fats tell when I was little. Anyway, I bring all that up because my subjective experience playing baseball, stealing bases, and how thrilling that was to be able to steal bases, I mean, it was so much fun. As much fun as stepping into the batter's box to hit against a guy throwing 90 miles an hour. Like, it's exhilarating. So my question is, would I be more likely to fall in love with baseball, become an addict of sorts of the sport, than, say, the first baseman, who for him, stealing bases, that's not even part of his experience playing the game. I'm thinking out loud here, but maybe it evens out because the first baseman is probably going to hit more dingers, and hitting a home run is definitely more thrilling than stealing a base. But what if you could do both? A la Aaron Judge or Barry Bonds back before his head got big. Literally, his head got a lot bigger. But who? It was Ricky Henderson, probably, who was the king of that. Home runs combined with stolen bases. I'm sure he's got the record. I also think you kind of accept your lot in life because the same could be applied to other sports, like the wide receiver scoring a touchdown. He's obviously thrilled, judging by how he acts like he's never been in the end zone before when he gets there. But maybe the thrilling sensations vary among us. Like, how do you explain perhaps the best running back of my lifetime, Barry Sanders, retiring in his prime? Or one of the best, another Detroit Lion, one of the best receivers to ever play the game, the guy they called Megatron, Calvin Johnson. Neither of them danced in the end zone. They both of them acted like they had seen the end zone before. And they both hung it up early. Is that a coincidence? I don't know. You remember last week how I was saying I wish I knew how much other people feel pain, like it's my 7, your 9, and vice versa? And I mentioned sex and some other vices, wondering like what if the addict feels something more or enjoys something 10x more than the next guy? That would make him so much more susceptible to addiction. And this could apply to addicts of all kinds, or alcoholics, which we now know, I've shared this before, but what best predicts alcoholism? It's not so much a genetic thing. Like if you grew up with an alcoholic father, you're likely to be one yourself. That might be true, but that's not the best indicator of whether you're going to be an alcoholic. Although it might be true that your dad was and therefore you are, but it's not as predictive as how susceptible you are to intoxication, regardless of whether your dad was an alcoholic. So the man or woman who gets drunk and gets happy real easily, that's the one who is that lightweightedness. Is that a word? Lightweightness is the best indicator we have as to who is going to be an alcoholic. Whom is going to be an alcoholic? I think it's who, but who cares? Well, it's the subject, right? So it'd be who. Whom, if you wanted to be proper or more formal, it would be whom is used when it's the object of a verb or preposition. Now you know. But me, as for me, I'm going to stick to who. But I was talking about, you can't know if that person with a problem, he just might enjoy certain things more than you do. Overeating would be another example. His mouth might water at the sight of cheesecake 10x more than what yours does, while you get cotton mouth walking into the Cheesecake Factory. A restaurant where no woman should go, by the way. Don't, if you're going on a date, don't take her to Cheesecake Factory. That's not a sexist joke. I'm not saying that to keep women from becoming beach whales. No, I'm saying that because they have a menu at the Cheesecake Factory that rivals War and Peace. And if she has trouble making a decision at Raising Cane's, the last place you want to take her is the Cheesecake Factory. But it's very possible that someone else might feel stronger sensations in their body when faced with different vices, and that's something we would never know. So I think that calls for some empathy. We just don't have that sort of insight into the human condition. Not yet, anyway. Or I used the example last week of the person who enjoys going to museums and staring at paintings, like Cameron and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Like, what if the guy who enjoys staring at a painting for 5 minutes gets that hair standing up on the back of his neck sensation, and the next guy feels nothing at all? I mean, I've heard gay guys say they like boobs. Yeah, no, you don't, Christopher. Not like we do. But the guy, the guy indulging in something and feeling overwhelming sensations in his body, or gets dopamine overload in his brain, it's going to be hard for him not to consume whatever that is. It might take every bit of will and strength that he's got to not do more of whatever it is that's giving him this thrilling sensation. The hair on the back of the neck sensation is so wonderful. I wonder if I don't live my life trying to create as much of that feeling as possible. Kids can help for you young kings out there. But I think that'd probably be a healthy pursuit, right? Since I don't think it comes from, I don't know that you get that feeling from doing crime or doing drugs. I think it generally comes from something awe-inspiring or something meaningful, which is why I mentioned the kids thing. But who knows what other people feel and the intensity with which they feel it. A lot of people aren't good at articulating what they're feeling anyway. Ask your woman. But Scott Adams, who I miss a lot, let's get into a few more reframes from his book, and then I'll have an update in the best movie ever and do some money stuff. I'll start where I left off last week. Let's see. The section is called Irrational Fears. He says you probably know someone who is afraid of flying, but not afraid of riding a bicycle. That's an example, he says, of reading the risk wrong, because flying is safer than riding a bike. It just looks or feels as if it would be more dangerous. He says you probably knew that already, but having this knowledge isn't good enough to conquer anyone's fear of flying, and that if you want to rewire your mind to fix an irrational fear, logic won't get it done. So the usual frame, he says, is safe things are safe, dangerous things are dangerous. His reframe is safe-looking things can be dangerous, dangerous-looking things can be safe. He uses this example of walking out. He walks out to a cliff by his house. So he lived in NoCal along in Northern California, right near the Pacific. He said you would think out of scuba divers, cliff jumpers, and snorkelers, snorkeling would be the obviously least dangerous activity of the three. But not so, he says, because the scuba divers and cliff jumpers take extra precautions because it can be dangerous. But snorkelers, especially those who aren't strong swimmers, often don't take the many precautions that scuba divers do. Then they end up moseying out too far from shore and get themselves in trouble. So what he suggests is repeating to yourself, because that's what makes reframes work, he says. It's not truth or logic necessarily, but repeating to yourself that safe-looking things can be dangerous and dangerous-looking things can be safe. He says all it takes to reprogram your brain is focus and repetition. Let me read this part to you because it is pertinent to what's happening now in the best movie ever. He writes, if you don't think simple repetition of phrases can program a brain, just look at anyone on the opposite side of politics from you. Don't those people look to you as if they have been programmed with mindless slogans that don't have any grounding in fact or logic? Yeah, that's like the White House Correspondents' Dinner shooter. Like bots, leftists are saying it was staged. They're not able to tell if somebody's a good person or not. Couldn't even tell you the difference between a man and a woman. Charlottesville, they don't think that was staged at all. The tiki torches, they're not wondering, well, how'd they get there? Or all the bricks when they have these riots? For all they know, Nazis make them at the Schindler factory, the tiki torches. Impeccable judgment they possess. J6, I could go on. They bought it hook, line, sinker. They're like, why would theater kids ever put on a giant theater production? What are you going to tell me baseball players play baseball next? And those racist insurrectionists, they weren't scaling the walls of the Capitol for a photo op. They had to do that. Sure, there were stairs 10 feet away, but they were sloped like that roof in Butler. You can't expect them to take the stairs. Speaking of mindless sloganeering, I have a lefty friend posted on social media It said, I just can't imagine wanting an entire secure ballroom for one man and not wanting gun reform for every child in America. Boy, when you're incapable of second-order thinking, that's what passes for thinking. The second order isn't available to them. That's how their mind works. It's just like, yeah, girl. Then you get some mansplainer in the comment asking, like, you seem smart. How would that work? You pass some gun reform and that guy, well, he would have handed over his guns? So who should have the guns then? Just the guys in the Trump administration? Military? Like, what else did you learn in grad school? But I digress. I think about the safety of air travel quite a bit, probably because I fly a lot. And I think probabilistically. So like even when I was a kid, like after my dad left, my mom wasn't home a lot. At night especially. So I'd be home alone. And I can remember getting so scared sometimes. I would stand in the corner of a room with a baseball bat. But fortunately, that only went on for a little bit because I was able to start thinking about odds and think. I got it from sports. I'm pretty sure that's how I was able to start thinking probabilistically. You learn so many statistics when you're obsessed with sports as a kid because you know everybody's batting average and how that's calculated, or basketball, coach makes the team run if you don't hit 80% of your free throws. So I remember being good at not just spelling and basic math, but fractions, because I knew, you know, you hit 2 out of 5 free throws, that's 40%. So many benefits of playing sports growing up, and that's one I don't hear talked about, is you should have the ability to ace statistics in your 101 class and once you get to college, because you've done so much of it since you were 6. So I started thinking, all right, there's 100 houses in my neighborhood, there are thousands of houses in my town, what are the odds a burglar would choose this one? And that would put me at ease. And you could think the same way about like home insurance. If you have, and I'm not saying I do this, but if you had a paid for house, you're not obligated to carry insurance on it. And, you know, like if Michael Jordan were to, like, do you think Michael Jordan has car insurance, or does he self-insure in case he ran his Ferrari into somebody or wrecked his Ferrari? He probably doesn't have, and I think he probably self-insures. Anyway, I bring that up because if you had a paid-for house, the odds of your house catching on fire is like 1 in 3,000. So if you wanted to play the odds and then just fund it or look at it as, man, that's really bad luck. I lost this, you know, $250,000 house. But if you were worth $20 million, you know, you might not insure it. But when I'm flying, I'm well aware that there are something like 45,000 flights a day, and that's just in America. So you would be incredibly unlucky if you were on one of those flights that went down. Did you know there's only ever been one person in history who's died from turbulence? So when you hear people screaming when there's severe turbulence, they're idiots. Because even that one, I believe it was an elderly person who wasn't wearing a seatbelt and so hit their head on the ceiling, and that's what killed them. Ooh, all right, this is a good section. It's about discovering sex appeal. He starts with the usual frame of nobody seems to find me attractive. His reframe is, you haven't met enough people. That sounds like advice I've given young guys who no longer want to be bachelors. Advice I've given them for quite a while now. Not to get worked up over meeting women. Where do I meet women? It's better just to meet people. You never know where your next tenderoni is going to come from. And you know the truth about a Roni. She's a sweet little girl. Adam says in the book, instead of focusing on the 90% of the people who don't find you attractive, think about the 10% of people who do. He says, in my case, talking about him, that means women who prefer smart men who are not likely to play in the NBA. And he adds, if I meet 100 women, maybe 10 will care about my mind more than my appearance, age, or whatever. And that's a lot. He says, if 10% doesn't sound like a lot, or if 1 in 10 women finding you attractive sounds like a weak consolation prize, consider that the best musical acts in the world are only enjoyed by no more than 10% of the world's population. And he says, if 10% of the public like you, for any reason, you're going to be very rich. He said, that's what worked for him. About 10% of people liked Dilbert, and it made him one of the most popular comic strip authors in the history of the world. He believes your best strategy for attracting people for romance is to work on your fitness and your diet. He says, if you get those right, you'll be one of the most attractive people in your environment, especially after the age of 30. He says, a woman once told him that a man with a job and a gym membership is already in the top 20% of desirable men. Then she said, to be in the top 10%, you just need to maintain your fitness and get a decent haircut. How about that? So top 20%, have a job and a gym membership. If you want to get in the top 10%, maintain that fitness and get a decent haircut. And what if you don't have hair? So in summary, he says, if things aren't working out for you in the romance department, meet more people. Play a sport, change jobs, join a club, whatever it takes. Yeah, just by increasing the number of people who know you, your odds of finding a suitable match go way up. Next section deals with humor, something he knows a lot about. He says, if you're not naturally funny, wouldn't it be nice to know how to create humor? Everyone likes a good laugh. He says, a stand-up comic will often create a joke by first describing what one group of people can get away with in society, then violating the pattern with, imagine me trying that. Like if a celebrity does some bad behavior and gets away with it, the comic follows that up with, imagine if, where the comic tries the same thing, but it doesn't work out. A better example, I think, is what he says something about movies. Oh, he's talking about a common plot device is the fish out of water, which is another way to say a quirky character is dropped into a situation for which they are not equipped. And he says hilarity ensues from that. And that too is a form of pattern violation that creates humor. I guess Buddy the Elf is the first one that comes to mind for that. Or Borat. Who else? How about Crocodile Dundee when he went to NYC? That'd be a good one too. So the usual frame, he says, the usual stuff is not funny. And the reframe is the usual patterns are violated. And that's funny. And he says that's why it's easy to write comedy gold for cops, for example. I used to love Reno 911. I remember my brother bought me the DVD set for my 30th birthday, which was a surprise party. If you've never been surprised, had a surprise party thrown for you, can't recommend it enough. I mean, I know you can't plan your own surprise party, but maybe you could plant the seed and then 7 years from now, somebody will surprise you. It's a really cool feeling that I still appreciate. In the book, there's an example of when somebody has a hole in their sock, but they feel guilty throwing it away because the unholy sock is going to lose his mate if the other one's thrown away. He says that's something everybody can relate to, having a holy sock. Although I think men are probably way more likely to hold on to that sock for dear life, maybe until Santa drops a new pair on us for Christmas. But if there's a hole in your drawers, that can be an asset. Am I right, fellas? I can give you a little breathing room. Oh, another one. So if you're in the professional world, if you're given a presentation, for instance, the same pattern violation can be effective. So if you were to deliberately violate the theme on a slide you were sharing with the audience, if you wanted to remember it or get them to remember it, you could violate the theme on the slide, and that'll make it the most effective slide. So do it for your most important one, and that can be effective. It can be risky, of course, but huge risk, huge reward. That's what we're trying to do here, right? In life, take big risks, big calculated risks, so we can get the big rewards. I used something like this one time. I was given a talk at a conference, and when I introduced myself, I said, you probably recognize me from your caller ID, because I was a cold calling salesperson. I cold called a lot. But I said, you can't ignore me this time. And I got a laugh. So ideally, you'd start all your talks with humor to kind of set the tone, you know? That's probably why I start these episodes with funnies. And do you catch that I say the word tone in a different tone? Yeah, it's by design. The next one is for married folks, or those who aspire to be soon, I guess. He says, we like to think of love as the process of finding a soulmate. If you believe we all have one soulmate on the planet, well, you probably don't want to read this, or you don't want to hear this part, but he says, realistically, humans can fall in love with whoever is nearby and willing, within reason. He says, well, this will bring some of you back if you thought about skipping this part. He says, obviously, you want to find someone who is compatible with you in as many ways as possible, but that the highest priority should be the promise you make to each other, not the love, and definitely not the soulmate part. He says you want to love your partner and feel that you're with your soulmate. That's a good thing. But romantic love and lust have a way of fading over time, which usually, this is me talking, usually, you know, the honeymoon phase usually lasts about 18 months on average. And that's no matter how diligent you are about keeping it fresh and hot. It's polarity that is a challenge to maintain. But he says, promises are different. A promise kept for a long time becomes what matters most. That the promise you make to look after another human till death do you part is the most valuable thing you can do or have. So you'd want to look for a partner, he says, that you can love. And but on top of that, make sure you find somebody who values making a promise, which to me means somebody that's going to keep their word, not somebody who's fickle or neurotic. You don't want to marry someone who is neurotic. They will leave you for the pool boy because they're not happy. Now, here this is for married people. I don't think married people are going to like hearing this. He says, monogamy for life is a pre-internet system. Back in the day, traditional marriage made sense because men and women brought different things to the marriage, things the other person couldn't easily provide. But in the age of equality, every individual can handle a solo life without much special effort. And for that group, where a mate isn't really needed, marriage is doomed to fail because over time, his words, not mine, over time, a spouse will generally start to look worse compared to a coworker, friend, or almost anyone else. Why? Because everyone but your spouse has the advantage of being able to present only their good side, an option that spouses don't really have, so they can't compete. And he says marriage would work better without the internet because the World Wide Web gives people access to countless alternatives. Therefore, a spouse will start to look flawed as more and more alternatives are being served up in their feeds. Then to make matters worse, even when they stop scrolling, they'll see endless love stories on TV of fictional people in movies who are happily married and make love all the time. They're always romantic. Then he talks about how many things can be predicted with the follow the money phrase, saying that if one partner can leave a marriage when they're, quote, unhappy and get a big chunk of money and an automatic babysitter by way of shared custody when the kids are young, that makes divorce seem like a good option, if not a practical option. And he talks about breakups. Man, this section of the book is pretty tough. He says, if you live a normal life, you'll probably experience several breakups, and they're going to hurt. Realistically, the only thing that heals is time. His frame here is, I want my relationship to last forever. The reframe is, nothing lasts forever. Life isn't designed to give you a happy ending. The great 20th century philosopher Avril Lavigne told us that, right? I mentioned that life is suffering last week. And if you don't think so, remember that everyone you know will someday disappear. And if you're my age, and you know, part of what sucks about getting older is that you see more and more people die. It's just a numbers thing. So that part of life is bad. It sucks as much as anything, but it's built into the experience. And as they say, when you're getting older, don't get sad. It's better than the alternative. But in the long run, businesses will fail. All governments will fail. Empires will fail. Whole civilizations will collapse. That's why you don't know any Mayans, or you don't know anyone who knows any Mayans. All right, lots going on in the best movie ever. We had yet another assassination attempt on President Trump. This one was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. First thing I noticed was the female law enforcement officers who were ducking in and hiding as the loser ran by him with a gun. You would think after the viral videos of Pat in the immediate aftermath of the butler thing that they would get women off these security details, but I guess, I don't know, what are they getting, the three-strike rule? I don't know. But we are making a lot of strides in returning to the natural order of things, in recognizing that men and women are not the same. I just hope we don't wait too long on that. I mentioned the sloped roof in Butler earlier. During the DEI craze, we had a woman leading the Secret Service who said with a straight face, maybe she was chosen for her ability to lie with a straight face, now that I'm thinking about it. But she said, Stoneface McGee, that they didn't have anybody on that roof where Thomas Crooks was because it had a sloped roof. And he was taken out by a sniper standing atop a roof that was even more sloped. Another disgusting takeaway from that ordeal was this latest one was the interview Trump did with Nora O'Donnell the next day, which I think was generous of him to grant her an interview, to grant anybody an interview who hates you. Good on you for doing that. So she reads what the guy who wanted to kill him said, that he was a rapist and a pedophile. And he's like, you are a disgrace for reading what this sick lunatic said in his manifesto. And O'Donnell, who tries to be a good actor, I mean, she was good enough to get hired by a major network, but she feigned surprise, like, oh, did you think he was talking about you? I know half the country struggles to tell when people are obviously acting, but that was the weakest attempt I've seen at trying to, she was trying to be sincere in playing stupid, and it was so obvious, and so I'm glad he called her on it. And I know other actors would think that was great, her leftist friends and such, but because they don't applaud good acting necessarily, they just appreciate the attempt. And go Team Blue and all that. But it was so pathetic. The one positive that could come out of this Correspondents' Dinner shooting, and I say could, is that, you know how I'm always saying that the communist has to feel pain themselves? That's the historical record. They must feel the boot on their neck, on their own neck. Otherwise, they'll never understand reality. They won't get what's happening. Well, if some of those media people at this Correspondents' Dinner were genuinely scared as they were hiding under tables, that could be a turning point for some of them. Could. I doubt it, but could. I'm just saying there's a chance. Because if one of them happened to be standing up, let's say they were going over to another table to steal a bottle of wine, and thanks to them tilting their heads slightly, only got their ear grazed by a bullet headed for Trump, then they might start seeing the light. They might wake up, might be forced out of the fantasy land that's been created for them, or that they helped to create themselves, or the red wine could become their red pill. You know, one interesting mystery among many is that all of the people the good guys are going after, something I've noticed is that the former FBI director, Christopher Wray, hasn't been mentioned. Do you think he's the one who maybe left little nuggets for Patel, like the burn bags? Because really, how do you put things in a bag to be burned and then not ensure they're burned? I'd be real curious about that. We should keep an eye on it. He's one of the few from the woke era who doesn't have a long face. This thriller of a movie of a mystery is getting so good. And speaking of FBI directors, James Comey, another former FBI director, they indicted him again, this time in North Carolina. So it is possible that Fruitcake will do some hard time. We'll have to wait and see. The last time they tried to get him in Virginia, and that was from making false statements to Congress, but not a lot of guys do jail time for that. Notable exceptions would be, well, at the start of the Communist Revolution, they put Roger Stone in prison, and then they also got Michael Cohen, who was Trump's attorney at one time. He eventually flipped on Trump, of course. He said he had flipped on Trump because his family said he should stop protecting Trump and focus more on his family. Which, a total coincidence, I'm sure, that he flipped when he got to the sentencing phase of his own troubles, of his own trial, and had to trade the suit and tie for a khaki uniform that looked like something I was forced to wear to school up until about fifth grade. In fifth grade, they finally let us wear a navy blue polo to tuck into our khaki pants. But that's a story for another time. But that first Comey case was thrown out because a federal judge said that the prosecutor was unlawfully appointed. It was that Lindsay Halligan, I think is her name. But Virginia is not the place to bring a case like that anyway. You're not going to convict a commie in a capital city, in almost any capital city. And Virginia is so close to D.C. Virginia is one of those states where you think the Republican might have a shot in a presidential election. A chance, I shouldn't say shot. Like maybe Virginia's purple and might swing both ways. But Virginia hasn't voted for a Republican president since G-Dub back in 04, when he had to beat a long-faced challenger. Think about him for a second, the guy he beat in 04, John Kerry. How much would somebody like that need to overcome to be likable? Which is what you'd need if you wanted people to vote for you. That guy, he was not only born into enormous wealth, but he then married the Heinz ketchup heiress, Teresa Heinz, which that's billionaire wealth. And that's something you don't really hear talked about with Trump. Like, I mean, you hear about him being a billionaire, of course. He's obviously likable. Everybody, to me, it seems like everybody who meets him and spends time with him seems to like him, even Bill Maher. You know, if you have a sense of humor, which I think it's something like a third of the population doesn't, those people are not going to like Trump. They're not going to find him funny at all. But you'd have to be the kind of person who could discern a good person from a bad person, which you'll get tired of hearing me say that some people just aren't good at that. And as I said last week, if you're a bad guy yourself, this wouldn't be one of your skills, unfortunately, to be able to tell who's good and who's not. But the world would be so much better of a place, right, without so many dupes. That is, until they count all the votes in the northern part of Virginia, you'd think Virginia could go Republican. But it's basically the Virginia, that northern part is, it's the D.C. suburbs, Arlington and Alexandria. D.C. votes Dem at about a 92% clip, which is the same amount of black vote Obama received when he was running in 2012. He got 92%. If Comey's found guilty on the 86-47 thing, I think what they ought to do to him is put him in a double wide somewhere out near the fence, out in the grass. That's what he said they should do to Trump. Oh, the karma thing. A sad thing with that guy. Or maybe the good thing about that guy is that all your life, wouldn't you have been real nervous if the director of the freaking FBI was after you? And now you see him for what he is, just this total flying fruitcake. Oh, this, I got to talk about this. There was a hearing on Wednesday where Brandon Gill, who's easily my favorite congressman, I don't do man crushes, or at least I like to think I don't. But that dude is sharp. He's got a haircut like Clark Kent. Beautiful family. He married Dinesh D'Souza's daughter. Google him if you want to see a beautiful family. And he's got this deadpan delivery that is superb. Anyway, what he did to this abortion advocate was epic. A word I don't use often because it's too often used. But I'm going to read what he said to you in case you missed it. So good. All right. Brandon Gill says to this abortion advocate, he says, "You're an advocate for abortion policy. What's your favorite type of abortion? Do you have a preferred method of abortion that you like?" And the woman says, "I'm an advocate for patients having access to the full realm of reproductive health care." So Brandon Gill says, "The first kind is called a suction abortion. This is when the cervix is dilated and a strong suction, 29 times the power of a household vacuum cleaner, tears the baby's body apart and sucks it through the hose into a container. Do you prefer that method?" The woman's Waters is her name. She says, "I stand by my former testimony." So Gill says, It sounds kind of gross, doesn't it? Sounds pretty gruesome. Do you agree? He continues, what about this one? This one is called dilation and cutterage, he says. After dilation of the cervix, a sharp looped knife is inserted into the uterus. The baby's body is cut into pieces and extracted, often by suction. Do you prefer that method? And this water woman says, what I believe we are here to talk about today is the FACE Act. We are not here to talk about the legality of abortion. And Gil says, you're a pro-abortion advocate. I'm asking if you prefer the dilation and cutterage method. You don't want to talk about abortion itself. Why is that? And Gil goes on to say, forceps are inserted into the uterus, grabbing and twisting the baby's body to dismember him or her. If the head is too large, it must be crushed in order to remove it. Do you prefer that method? And Waters says, I would prefer to talk about the reason the hearing was called and the basis of my expert testimony. He says, the baby's skin is burned off. The baby ingests the solution and dies of salt poisoning, dehydration, and hemorrhaging of the brain. Referring to saline injection abortion, he says, do you prefer that method? And this woman says, I would prefer to talk about the subject of the hearing. And then Brandon Gill says, this is the subject of the hearing. This is about protests outside of abortion clinics. I'm asking you about abortion. I wouldn't want to talk about this either if I were you, because it is barbaric and evil. How about that? Never in my life have I seen anything like that. An interaction where all the abortion euphemisms that allow these women to flaunt themselves as being high and mighty and so caring and empathetic and I believe in choice and all that. Well, this discussion was where all the high-minded, we're the good people caricature they've created for themselves as long as I've been alive, that's where it goes to die. And it was incredible to watch. What he did was force some cancer, some feminist, same thing, forced her to do some second-order thinking for the first time in her life, which I don't even think they're capable of. But he pierced the facade of this woman, who I'm sure she thinks very highly of herself. I mean, that's kind of the whole point of being a progressive, right? Is you get to think highly of yourself, because as a surface-level thinker, you're content just to feel. That's what it's about. Consequences be damned. And you don't want to know details. The truth is pretty jarring. So I'm sure she didn't feel too good after that conversation. At least not until she met all her friends for avocado toast with her Jennifer Newsom friends and said, that Brandon Gill, he is such a mean misogynist. Can you believe that, a-hole? Yeah, girl, let's get all our partners in the media to demonize this guy, and maybe a tranny will get to him with a rifle. All right, let's do some money stuff before we wrap. According to Mr. Bellello again. He always provides great value on money stuff. He says Americans spent over $109 billion on lottery tickets last year. That's more than they spent on movies, books, concerts, and sports tickets combined. And this is interesting. The annual income needed to be in the top 1% of your country. And this is in American dollars. I've got a little list here for you. In Pakistan, to be in the top 1%, you'd need to make $8,000 a year. In India, it's $20,000. South Africa, $35,000. Brazil, $45,000. Mexico, $52,000. Colombia, $48,000. Now you know why passport bros head to Colombia, because you not only get the passion, but the median income in America last year was, what, $83,000, I believe? So your average American male, he can move to Medellin and be in the top 1% of earners. Up in that same category with Pablo. Spain, to be in the top 1% of earners, you would need to make $120,000 a year. Japan, $175,000. Germany, $180,000. Damn, $180,000. I'm pretty sure my German buddies are 1%ers, and I didn't even know it. I bet you they don't know it either. Canada, 210, the UK 220, Australia 230, Norway 290K a year, Singapore 350, and the US to be in the top 1%, 650,000 a year. All right, let me leave you with something I sent to a few of my guys last week. That way we can end on a positive note. No, you know what? I want to go negative first before I end here on a positive note. Maybe that'll enhance the positivity, maybe. Those of you who have listened for a long time to the Man-O Pod know that I'm a big fan of the Stoics and have been for a while. And the modern man who lives today, who has sold himself as sort of the Stoic guru, is somebody I'm not a fan of. I've never met him. I know people who have met him, but I can tell he's just not my kind of guy. He's got this effeminate, long face that just rubs me the wrong way. And I shouldn't say that because you can't really help your face shape, but they all somehow think the same way, and I don't get it. But saying that, I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. His name rhymes with Ryan Holiday in the way rappers rhyme these days. Like, Kiki, do you love me? Say you'll never ever leave from beside me. You know, they rhyme me and me. But it's not the feminine act that gets me. My beef is more that he's a phony. He's a fraud. To his credit, though, he writes books worth reading. And I've read several of them. And I do like them, most of them. But he is about the worst spokesperson. Put it this way. He's as good a spokesperson for Stoicism as Sam Harris is for mindfulness and meditation. And I bring him up because he posted a response to something that Ivanka Trump said recently. So she put out a video where she's saying that she's a big fan of Marcus Aurelius and she loves the book Meditations. And she said particularly she likes the part about how Aurelius would say that your soul becomes dyed with the color of your thoughts. So it was a really thoughtful, positive kind of message and how she tries to live by that and raise her kids. And Holiday posts this video and just on the Daily Stoic account, and he goes into this childish tirade about her dad. And I don't know if you know this, but maybe they've rekindled, I doubt it, but he disowned his dad because his dad supported Trump. Anyway, what else do you need to know about the guy? But on a positive note, K-Paxis is an account I talk about a lot. I'm quite fond of his writing. He wrote something that I think is great advice, regardless of where you are in life. And I need to pull it up real quick. I saved it. Give me just a second here. K-Paxis said... Oh, he's talking... This is why I sent it to my guys, because this is so important. He says, asking is the closest thing to a cheat code in real life, as it has asymmetric payoffs, no downside, infinite upside. If you ask and the answer is no, you're exactly where you started. If you ask and the answer is yes, you've gained something. The expected value of asking is almost always positive, and yet we don't ask. Why? Because we've internalized a false belief that asking and being rejected is far worse than asking at all. We treat no as punishment rather than as information. But here's what actually happens when you ask for things. He says 40% of the time they say yes. 30% of the time they say no but suggest an alternative. 20% of the time they say no. 10% of the time they ignore you completely. In 70% of the cases, you're better off than if you hadn't asked. In 20% of cases, you're exactly where you started. In 10% of cases, you're slightly worse off. You wasted the time to compose the message. I guess this is assuming you're cold emailing or something. He says, once you internalize this, asking becomes automatic. Not asking becomes the thing that needs to be justified. I like that a lot. That's why I shared it. And that's all I got for you this week. If you're out there in the heat, it's starting to get hot out there. I hope you're hydrating and staying positive and filled with love and gratitude for this short time we have on Earth. I'm glad you're listening, and I appreciate hearing from all you guys. I'm starting to hear from more and more of you every week, and I really like that. So keep the feedback coming. I'll chat back at you soon, and God bless y'all. Bye-bye.